maybe. You better hope the market goes up. You better hope everything goes really, really well. You better hope you don't have to replace that roof ever. You better hope that your tenant never leaves and you never have to evict them. Because if that happens, you might just lose the property because you don't have, or you have it so far leveraged, right? And so we got to be careful with over-leveraging. Hello and welcome to Pillars of Wealth Creation, where we talk about creating financial success with a special focus on business and real estate. I'm your host, Todd Dexheimer. Now, let's get to it. Are you ready to start investing in real estate today but don't know where to start? Sometimes investing can seem way too complicated, but it actually couldn't be any easier than with homeinvest.com. You know the co-founder and my friend, Nate Armstrong. He appeared on episode 20, and if you haven't heard it, go back and listen to it, episode number 20. Home Invest is a company that allows you to invest in turnkey real estate. Their goal is to build powerful investment tools that make real estate investing accessible to everyone. They have contractors and property managers available for you with the click of your mouse. While other real estate agents can only offer a property, Home Invest brings you a full turnkey package that allows you to diversify your investments, earn passive income, and start building equity in properties. Their simple, intuitive design allows newcomers and experienced investors alike to hit the ground running and to be able to choose the properties when they want and where they want. View easy to understand charts and data to allow you to buy in only a few clicks or just a simple phone call. With Home Invest, you'll be building a portfolio as quickly or as slowly as you would like. And right now, Home Invest is giving our listeners, Pillar of Wealth Creation listeners, a free course on how to finally win in real estate investing. So go to homeinvest.com/pillars. That's homeinvest.com/pillars to claim your free course today. Hey, welcome back to Pillars of Wealth Creation. I'm your host, Todd Dexheimer. With me, as always, on these hump day hustles is John Stiles. John, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Todd. It's a good day to be alive.
Every day is a great day, John. And that's kind of what we talked about last week, right?
Yep.
It got me in it, you know, it's funny that episode, and it really, I had been thinking about it for quite some time. So if you didn't listen to what previous Wednesday's episode, which is episode 115, go back and listen to it. Maybe some people might not like, cause it's, you know, some people don't like, I used to not like the corny, cheesy stuff like that, you know, but now I'm all in on it. So I love it now. So, but it just got me like totally positive in a completely different mindset. And I don't know what it did for you, if it did anything, but it moved the needle big time for me. Just thinking about it, you know, I wrote about it obviously. And then I talked about it, and I've been like constantly thinking about it, and it's totally like different mindset. I've been practicing a lot of it too. You know, every morning I've been getting up. So I've been reading a book called The Miracle Morning by Hal Elrod, and I got to get him on the show. It'd be great to have him on the show. Super interesting guy. But I've been following that too. I've been getting up an hour earlier, actually a little bit more than that, about an hour and probably 20 minutes earlier than I had been before. And I've been going through this kind of morning routine. Have I already talked about this on the show? I feel like I've already talked about it.
I don't know. I don't think so.
All right. Sweet. I talk about it to other people. So I just like, it all blends together at times. But, you know, so part of it was, it maybe came from this book. Part of it, like I said on the last episode, came from like listening to these politicians. And I don't listen to a lot of it, but every once in a while, if I'm in between podcasts or maybe my old phone hadn't been charging when I would plug it in and listen through my podcast. So I had been listening to a decent amount of radio. So you'd hear these like political ads. And then the other thing in the mail, like you get all these political ads and like, who's this jerk that, you know, it's like, geez, you know, all these political ads have like their opponent, like, yelling at somebody with like flames coming out of their head. And it's like, they're trying to demonize these people. It's like, you know what? You just make yourself look like a jerk by sending this, you know? So, and I barely pay attention to them. Just basically like throw them in the garbage, make sure this isn't anything I need to look at. Nope. Throw it in the garbage. But anyway, so it got me like thinking that whole political thing, got me thinking about it. Cause there's so, people are so freaking negative around that. And anyways, so it just has made me really be positive in this Miracle Morning, which if you haven't read it, John, I'd suggest doing it. It's really just about making your morning purposeful. And I'm not necessarily a morning person. I would say I'm more productive from, you know, 8:30, 9 p.m. after my kids are in bed till about, you know, 11, 11:30. I'm very productive during that time. So waking up earlier in the mornings can be challenging because I'm very productive in the evening. But I've committed to it, and I've so far really liked it. So I get up, and I've tried to commit to it before, but what I've done before is I wake up and I'll try to read right away, and then I'll fall back to sleep. And then, okay, so now I got to get out of my bed and try to read. So then I'll get out of my bed, I'll go downstairs, I'll sit on the couch, and I'll start reading, and I'll fall asleep on the couch. So what I've done now is the first thing I do is I get up, and Hal says, hey, go brush your teeth. So I go brush my teeth. And I splash some water on my face. Then I go downstairs and I fill up a big cup of water, put some lemon juice inside of that. And then I drink that cup of water. Then I fill up another cup, throw some lemon juice, and then I slam that cup of water. So I'd slam two cups of water, like this beautiful green cup that I always drink from, which has got some lemon juice in it still. I like lemon juice now in my water. I never did that before, but I love it now. And it's supposed to actually be, it's supposed to, lemon juice is supposed to get the, change your acidic balance of in your stomach. So it's supposed to neutralize your stomach. So anyways, so then what I've been doing now is I get up, I do that. And then once I'm done drinking my two glasses of water, then I do just a 10 minutes worth of exercise. I do sit-ups, push-ups, pull-ups, pull-up bar behind me. I've got some dumbbells. I do some curls, and I've got my fireplace mantle sits up a little higher. So I do some tricep dips. You know, just stuff like that, just for 10 minutes. Then what I do after that is then I read. And when I read, I've been standing up and just walking. And then I'll maybe sit down and I'll stretch, but I'm not sitting on the couch because if I sit on the couch, I fall back to sleep. So then after that, I pray, I meditate, and I do affirmations, and then I write, I blog, or not necessarily blog, but just write my thoughts. And I try to do these in like 10-minute intervals, and it's been awesome. It's just been really cool for me. It just feel like, all right, now I'm set. I'm ready for the day. I've got things that I want to do. That you always want to like accomplish these things. You want to read, you want to, you know, pray or meditate. You want to do these affirmations because you hear they're good for you. Right. And you, when you do it, you're like, yeah, that was awesome. But you, for me, I never like set that time for it. And now it's like strict. This is what I'm doing from when I wake up for just over an hour, I do it for. So it's been awesome. That's cool. Not at all what I wanted to talk about today, by the way.
Right. And that's all from the book you're reading or you, other things too?
Basically from the book I'm reading. But yeah, honestly, before I even read that book, I'd been wanting to do it for so long. And that's actually why I bought the book. I'm like, maybe if I buy this book, it'll kick me into gear. So I bought the book, sat on my shelf. And then I went, you know what? I got to read this book because I'm never going to commit to it. So I started reading the book and like, by the time I got to like page three, I committed to it and I've been doing it ever since. Page three didn't even talk about the Miracle Morning. So I've been doing it ever since. Yeah. But today, John, today we're going to talk about cap rates, cash on cash return, IRR, debt service coverage ratio, all these things that people say are really important when we're analyzing an apartment building. And it's like, well, what's really important? Like, what's the most important? Is there like that one magic thing that we should be looking at? And I see it all the time. Some people go, well, cap rate. What cap rate should I buy things at? What should my cash on cash return be? That type of stuff. And then I see other people going, oh, don't pay any attention. There was just, I was on BiggerPockets, a forum. Somebody asked that type of question and somebody responded back, don't pay attention to cap rates. Cap rates are just not important at all. You shouldn't even think about them. And I'm going, well, that's really bad advice. So we have to decide what are our, you know, we could underwrite till our face turns blue and then we can't decide what a good deal is because we don't know what we're truly gauging our deal on. And a lot of it, honestly, is subjective, right? There's no magic number. It really depends on what your criteria is. But all of those things that I've mentioned are important. So we really need to kind of dig into them to understand if they're, you know, what's important and what's not. So that's kind of what I want to talk about today.
Yeah, those are really good. I mean, it's important to understand some of those definitions too. Maybe, I mean, I know we don't want to get too deep in the weeds on that, but should we define some of that real quickly?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Do you have any of them that you want to take on right away?
Well, let's just start with cap rate. That is the net operating income.
Yep. So
your
income, not including your mortgage.
Right. Income minus expenses before your mortgage or debt service. And then you take that number, the NOI, divided by the value or the sale price, and that would equal your cap rate.
Yep. Yeah. So if you got an NOI of $100,000 and a value of $1,000,000, you've got a cap rate of a 10, right? You've got a 10 cap, which is really good. Okay. And we'll go later why that's important. So, what's cash on cash, John?
Cash on cash. No, I didn't have that one in front of me here. Do you have it?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, cash on cash is as simple as it's what amount of money do you have in there and what amount are you making off of that each year? So, you know, what are we looking for is cash on cash. If I have $100,000 into it and I'm making, you know, $10,000 off of that, that's a 10% cash on cash. Right. And so we want to try to get the highest cash on cash possible, but that can be also dangerous too, because some people go, well, obviously the best way to get a great cash on cash is I leverage this thing to the hilt, right? If I only got, you know, if I can take instead of $100,000 and get this mortgage and then get a second mortgage and really, really max this thing out, maybe get a private loan on there and I'm paying them some interest rate, I can really max it out. Yeah, my cash flow drops down and now I'm only making, you know, instead of $10,000, I'm only making $3,000, but I only have $5,000 into it. My cash on cash, you know, is huge right there, right? I'm almost making my money back year one. By middle of year two, I've made my money back. That's great, right? Well, maybe. You better hope the market goes up. You better hope everything goes really, really well. You better hope you don't have to replace that roof ever. You better hope that your tenant never leaves and you never have to evict them. Because if that happens, you might just lose the property because you don't have, or you have it so far leveraged, right? And so we got to be careful with over leveraging. Leveraging is a beautiful thing. And I've leveraged a lot of my properties to be able to take all of my money out of it. But at the same time, when I do that, I'm really cognizant of a lot of other things. What is my overall cash flow and what's my debt to service? And you know, what are my reserve account looking like? So we got to look at the whole picture. So cash on cash is great, but cash on cash, like you said, or like I said, I guess, is what you've put into it and what you're getting out of it So 100,000 in, 10,000 out, that means you're getting 10%.
Right. Yep. Yeah. You really got to balance that between, you know, if you are leveraging it, do you have enough cash flow to pay all that debt service? You know, and are you really interested in paying all that interest? Is it worth it that so?
John, what's the, you know, our cash flow? That's pretty simple. What's cash flow?
Yep. So that would be similar to the NOI, but after you put in your debt service, you know, how much money do you have at the end of the day?
Right. So right. And that's really important to focus on as well. Some people don't focus on cash flow. They focus on all these like metrics and they forget that cash flow is really important. Like I said in the last one, we can have a fantastic cash on cash return. But if we got very little cash flow, you can be in big trouble. Same thing with cap rate. I can have a fantastic cap rate, but if I'm leveraging the thing way more than what I should, or there's other factors that are negatively playing into it, you could have a terrible investment.
Yep, definitely. So cash flow is super important, especially to just maintain your reserves and actually, you know, to actually make money off of the deal and have money to spend.
Yep. So anything else? What else haven't we covered? What do you got?
We haven't covered internal rate of return.
Sure. Do you have the definition of that?
I don't have it in front of me.
Okay. So IRR, internal rate of return, people call it IRR, simply is the time value of money. So first of all, let's cover return on investment, right? So you've got your return on investment, which is tied to your cash on cash, but we're also considering we're going to sell it in, let's call it 5 years. So if we go, we're going to sell this thing in 5 years, we're going to get our cash flow, we got our principal reduction, and we have our profit upon sale, right? So we have those three things that we can take into account. Well, if we invested $1 million and we get our $1 million back plus another million in profit between our cash flow, between our principal payoff, and between the appreciation that either we forced or the market forced. If we create another $1 million, we made 100% return on our investment, which is in 5 years, that's a 20% ROI, simple return on investment. Okay. Now, what an IRR does is say, well, that's right, but it was back end loaded, right? We only made some of that up front. The rest of it was made in the back end. So we didn't really make 20% every year. You made 10% first year, second year, third year, fourth year, and then fifth year, you made the rest. And so what IRR takes into account is the time value of money, saying, well, if we each year paid this, what would we be making? And that's typically then going to go down. So typically it's going to be, let's say we make a 20% return, simple return on investment on average, the IRR might be more like 16-17% because we're taking into consideration again that we didn't receive all that money day one and day two and day three. We received it over time and back end loaded. So that's what IRR is the what's your return on investment taking into consideration the time value of money on a yearly, on an annual basis. So
yeah. And that was a little bit more complicated to figure out because you got to project the sale price in X number of years and a lot of other factors in there.
Yep. And that's where people are manipulating things too. And that's where it's dangerous when you're looking at investments and you're going, well, how did this person way overpay what I was willing to pay? Is because they're projecting, potentially projecting high sale prices and all that kind of stuff. So that's where I focus a lot on IRR, good, bad, or otherwise, but that's where it can become difficult to then be able to pay the price you need to pay in order to get the property, because you're guessing, right? I mean, there's certain things we know. There's other things we can be fairly accurate on, and then there's other things where we're kind of guessing, or we call them projecting, but it's still a guess. So that's, you got to be careful on that. The last thing is debt service coverage ratio, John. What's that? Do you have that in front of you?
I should have put all these definitions in front
of you. Well, I told you that we weren't going to be defining these things, but it is important. So your debt service, basically, without defining it too much, is basically how much, what's your ratio between your profit, what you're actually making, and your mortgage. And we want a debt coverage ratio of 1.25 or better. I like closer to 1.5, 1.4, 1.5 after it's stabilized. Now, sometimes when it's not stabilized, I'm okay with smaller debt service coverage ratio. So basically, is my income, is my total income, my cash flow, going to be 1.25 times greater, 1.2 greater than my actual debt payments. So that's kind of
back that up. You said cash flow, but I think you meant NOI.
Yeah.
So is your NOI 1.25 or greater?
Right.
Debt service.
Yep.
And that one in particular, the banks typically focus on a lot because they want to make sure they're going to get
Right. And so as you're making an offer, if you're trying to offer and you think, okay, I'm going to get this property tied up, that's great. But you're at 1.1%, 1.1 debt service coverage ratio. Well, are you ever going to be able to get a loan? Probably not. Probably not at that amount of debt that you want. So there's two options. One is to pay less. The other one is to put more money into the property for the down payment to get that debt service coverage to where it needs to be. And that's what banks and lenders will make you do. So instead of going 75%, maybe you got to go 60% or 65%. So debt service coverage is definitely important when we're looking at, can we actually finance this property? Right. And just being conservative. Like I said, I like to be closer to 1.5 because I want to make sure my NOI, the chunk of cash that I've got at the end of the day, at the end of the month, is going to be able to actually pay for my mortgage. If it can't pay for my mortgage, why do the deal? Right. I'm going to be hurting. So, and actually I hear people say that all the time. They just want somebody who said that the other day, they just want a tax write-off with real estate. That's a terrible idea. You don't want to buy real estate for just a tax write-off. Please don't buy real estate just to lose money. That's what the person said. He's going to be losing. He was losing like $700 a month, but it's a great tax write-off and I got a big tax problem. Well, then give me a check for $700 a month. Like, I'll be happy to take it. I think that's crazy. And if you've got a tax problem, that's a good thing, right? I mean, that means you're making a lot of money. Now, can we do things smart to try to mitigate or try to help with that tax problem? Yeah, but we should still be making money off of our investments. If you're losing money, what's the point, right? Just give it to government then.
Right. Yeah.
That's like people saying there's something on sale, so they're going to go buy it. Well, would you have bought it before if it wasn't for sale? Well, no. Okay. Don't buy it. Hey, I want to interrupt this episode real quick to talk to you about Nate Armstrong, our sponsor, Nate Armstrong. He's with homeinvest.com and you want to get to know Nate. So go to homeinvest.com and just connect with Nate, talk to him, learn about his operation, what he's got going on. He's a turnkey provider and it may not be right for you, but it could be the perfect fit. So it doesn't hurt. It's a free call, free consultation, just to figure out, what they do, what they have to offer. And worst case is you're going to meet a great person who's really well educated in real estate. He's done a ton of different real estate strategies and probably is going to teach you a little bit, even on a short conversation with him. So go to homeinvest.com and connect with Nate's company. You're definitely not going to be disappointed. It's worth it. So thanks, and we'll get back to our show. So kind of what I wanted to just cover, now that we've kind of covered the definitions and some other things, is what's it really important and why? And for me, let's start back with cap rates. And cap rates are very important to me. It's not necessarily like the end all be all, but you want to look at, when you're looking at cap rates, is what's the historic cap rate been at? Where are we at right now with cap rates in that market? And why is there a difference? So if the historic cap rate, let's call it for a neighborhood, is at 6.5 and today it's 5.5. Well, why is there a difference? Did that neighborhood improve? If the answer is yes, that neighborhood improved, okay, I can see that difference sticking around. And did it improve as drastically as a 1-point spread? Because that's big, right? What are competing neighborhoods? What were they at? So let's say this neighborhood did improve. You go, okay, well, now this neighborhood's as good as, good as Uptown, right? And so what did Uptown, what has that traditionally been selling at a cap? If that's been selling traditionally at a 5.5 cap, now I go, okay, well, that makes sense. But if Uptown traditionally sold at a 6 cap, and I go, well, this is at a 5.5, but it's no better than Uptown, well, I've got to underwrite based on at least a 6 cap, right? Because there's no reason for it other than maybe the market emotions are now telling us that people are willing to pay that. But when I underwrite, especially for my exit, I've got to be cognizant of that likely the market's not always going to be as hot as it is today. So that's something with cap rates that we got to really look at. Cap rates are important, not necessarily on what you buy it at, because I'm okay with paying a 5 cap on a property that's in a 6 or 7 cap neighborhood. As long as there's things you can do to that property to get that value up. What's important is when you sell the property. So in my underwriting, what I try to focus on is, what is my exit cap rate potentially going to be at? And I'm looking at what historically it's been at, how much it shifted, what's happening with that neighborhood. And I'm trying to best project where I think the cap rate is. Knowing today's market, we know that cap rates are compressed. So we know we likely have to underwrite up. You know, I'm typically underwriting anywhere between 0.75 all the way up to 1.5-point increase on cap rates. And this is subjective. It depends on the market. But cap rates are really important, especially when you're looking at selling the property and determining what the value will be in the future. We want to focus on that. It's also, I think, important on the buy, just knowing where today's cap rates are, where they have been, and understanding how much you're either overpaying or underpaying for that property and where you're at. It's not the end all be all.
And the other thing to keep in mind is, a lot of times cap rates are different for A-class properties versus B, C-class properties, as yep. we talked about a couple of weeks ago. And so if you're focused in on one neighborhood and one property, make sure you're comparing cap rates that are to similar types of properties, not right. just, you know, you can't compare one B-class to the A-class and think you're, or C to A or whatever, and just think that it's all going to be apples to apples.
Yeah, different property types, different neighborhood types as well. And some people get caught up in that and they get lost in that. Maybe they've got a property that's in a, you know, B-plus location, and their property is built in 1960, and they're underwriting it towards a building that was built in 1995. Those are two different buildings, likely going to be worth two different amounts based on a per unit basis, based on a cap rate basis. So that's the other thing we haven't mentioned yet, and I just mentioned it, is per unit. What are these properties selling per unit? So you want to find like-kind properties that have a similar mix of ones and two bedrooms or three bedrooms or whatever you got, similar mix. And you want to look at that and go, okay, what has price per door been typically selling at? That's also an important metric because people do look at that too. Investors, buyers, they look at this thing selling for $150 a door, but the next property that is sold, the next highest property is only sold for $110 a door. I don't think I'm paying $150 a door. There's no way. So people, even if that's a 5.5 cap and the other property sold as a 5.5 cap, even if that's the case, a lot of people just aren't going to be able to wrap their head around paying that massive difference on a per door basis. And so you're probably going to get something in between. So that's really important too, to just more than cap rate, we got to look at comps too. A lot of people say multifamily, we don't have comps or we don't pay attention to comps. I think that's definitely the wrong advice to be giving when people say, well, we base it on NOI. Well, that's true to an extent.
Yeah. Well, there are typically fewer comps than if you're looking at the single family market. So it can be more of a challenge to find those comps, but when they do exist, you know, do your best to find them and then make sure you're digging into those numbers.
Yep. Yeah. And your local brokers are going to be a good resource. That's one advantage among many of working with local brokers versus just trying to do it all on your own, is that they have resources that they can really dig into. And a lot of them, especially if you're working with a bigger company like CBRE and Marcus and Colliers and ARA and all those, is they've got major, major resources and databases, and they can pull a lot of information to be able to show you what is going on in the market and what things are selling for. So there is an advantage of working with companies or brokers, I should say. And really, honestly, what I would look for with a broker is, do they have a, Reese or CoStar subscription? Like, can they pull that information? If they have it, then they're a broker I would consider working with. If they don't have it in multifamily, I would think that's a challenge to work with that broker, because how do they have their pulse really on their fingertips? Or,
pulse on the market.
Pulse on the market. So, John, do you have a Reese or CoStar?
Yeah, I do have Reese.
So John's a good broker to work with.
Thank you for the plug.
Well, honestly, though, I mean, if you didn't have it, it'd be hard for me to refer you as a broker or as an agent, because you don't have the data. And so you're okay to sell a 5-unit or a 15-unit, but if somebody comes to me and says, hey, who should I use to sell my, 50 or 100 unit property? I can't recommend John Stiles because, he doesn't have information. He doesn't have data. He doesn't know how to analyze your property. But if you do, which you do, now I can recommend you because, you've got that information. So anyways.
There's a lot that goes into it. We try to do all the analysis we can ourselves, but there's so much data out there that you have to have access to, and a lot of research goes into it. So,
yeah, absolutely. So, for me, when I'm looking at underwriting, I want to tie everything together. So, I do want to look at what my cash on cash return is. I do want to make sure that's strong every year from the beginning. And maybe the first year actually is very weak, potentially, depending on what I'm doing to that property. That often happens to me, is where my first year and even just into the second year is really weak. But I want to make sure that we can get it to be strong. I want to make sure we can get it that double digit cash on cash by year three or four. By year five, it's 100% necessary to be in the double digits, in my opinion. And we want to be able to return, for me, I have investors, so I want to be able to return my investors a good return. If I can't return them, money on an annual cash flow basis, well, then I'm in trouble. right? And it's not going to work very well. So cash on cash and cash flow are two different things. And they're both to me vitally important. I want to make sure I'm providing good income to my investors and to myself. I want to make sure I'm providing good return to my investors and myself. So those are really important, and they can be different. So that's something to pay attention to. You think, well, if the cash on cash is good, the cash flow must be good as well. That's not necessarily true. So you got to make sure cash flow actually makes sense.
Yep. For cash, is there any particular numbers that you really look for? We've talked a lot about cap rates, and that's a lot of based on the market. You know, what are things going for? When it comes down to, and then we talked about debt service ratio, you know, the banks influence that a lot, and then you have your personal preferences with that too. What about cash flow? Is there a certain per unit, per month that you look for?
Yeah, so I'd like to be able to get my building, you know, again, I buy a value add, so right up front, it's not going to potentially not going to be there, but I like to have my buildings be able to make, you know, $100 a month per unit on cash flow. If I'm struggling making that, then it's going to be tough for the building to make a lot of sense. You know, maybe on an A class, you know, we can get a little bit less than that, but still we should be closer to that, you know, $80 to $100 a month per unit to get for our cash flow for that to make sense. And so then debt service, like we've already covered, you know, that we need to be able to get that to me. You got to be able to hit the bank numbers. But I think 1.4, 1.5 or better is a really good metric, because we want to make sure there's enough cash to pay for that mortgage. That's really important. So if you're at 1.2, which is the minimum typically, and that's going to be enough to make it work. Again, it's going to depend on the property, the property size. You know, the larger the property, the easier it is to make it work. But you think about if just a few things go wrong, you're digging into your pocket. So the thing with the debt service to be aware of, if you're going to have a lower debt service, especially if you're doing a value add, you start out at 1.2. It's really important to have a good reserve account. Really, really important. So for me, I always have 9 months worth of principal and interest payments set aside. So my mortgage, I've got 9 months of it covered. If for some reason I'm not making that cash flow, I did a value add, but maybe when I bought the property, 20 tenants out of, you know, 200 moved out because of whatever reason. Maybe they just weren't even paying rent before to the other person and we have to evict them. Whatever the reason is, if my cash flow dips down and I can't cover my debt service, I need to have that reserve account. So that's really, really important in a value add, especially when you're getting to that tight debt service of 1.2 or under.
Yep.
So John, when I'm looking and analyzing deal, these numbers are all really important. The cash flow is important, all this stuff. But one of the other really important things is I want to be able to paint a picture, right? I want to be able to understand what can I actually do to this property to improve its value? Can I improve its value? Can I change its story? Can I change the look and the feel of this building? And that's really, really important. That's going to play a big factor into our projections. That's going to play a big factor into whether this building is worth actually acquiring or not. Because if I can't change the story, if I can't make this building better than it is right now, unless you're getting such a good deal, which you're not in this market, you're just not, it's not worth doing it. So we have to be able to paint a picture with the building. And so that's definitely subjective. That's definitely something you have to really dig into and try not to get emotional with. I think a lot of people do get emotional because they want a building so bad. There's a lot of people that want to buy multifamily right now. I'm coaching people on multifamily and they want to buy. They want to buy tomorrow. And And it's important to understand, like, you don't need to buy tomorrow. We want to make sure you're completely prepared and ready to go before you buy. And you'll understand how to paint that picture. You understand what you're doing and versus you're just emotional about that property. So that's really, really important when we're looking at our underwriting, is, you know, all these other factors, what's going on in the market, and can we really make these positive changes to the property that we're wanting to make to get our projections and our numbers to get to the spot that we need.
Yeah. Speaking about kind of being emotional about it, I mean, we look at the returns that are potentially there with multifamily investment, and we can think to ourselves, man, if I just get one great building, I could quit my job, or I could just be financially free. And that may be true, but, you know, are you financially ready to make that purchase? And if you get so excited about it, are you going to be actually in a financial problem where you can't withstand, you know, the bumps in the road that come our way? So,
yeah. Well, yeah. And I just mentioned 100-unit building at $100 a month. I mean, 100 times 100, that's $10,000 a month. A lot of people can quit their jobs based on $10,000 a month, especially when you think of real estate and you've got tax advantages of it. You know, so it's probably close to $100 a month, or sorry, $10,000 a month, you know, without paying taxes. So that's a good thing. So we get excited about it, but in reality, we want to make sure that is reality. Like, can we really actually do that and not try to get ahead of ourselves? And what does that really mean? And what does that really look like? And are we potentially going to get ourselves in trouble and going to be upside down in these properties if the market does shift and when it does shift? So those are really important things to consider and factors to know whether we want to do a deal or not.
Yep. Very good. So it's, when you consider all these things, you know, it's not just one indicator. It's all these different things kind of in an overlay fashion where they all are very important to consider and they all influence each other. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Everything works together. We can't just focus on one. You're going to end up likely overpaying or never getting a deal if you're just focusing on one. I see people posting, I'm looking for an 8 cap or a 10 cap or whatever. Well, what's that really mean? You know, what's an 8 cap truly mean? Like, are we buying an 8 cap in a D neighborhood? We're buying an 8 cap with no value add. We're buying an 8 cap, you know, with little cash flow. Like, what's that really mean? So we got to look at the whole picture. The other thing to consider too, and we haven't even mentioned this, other thing to consider is your loan. What type of loan can you actually get? Are you able to get a 30-year or 35-year HUD loan that's fixed for the entire time at 4.5%? Like, that's a great loan, right? Maybe. That's a great loan if you're planning on keeping it for 35 years. It's a fantastic loan if you're trying to keep it for, I would say, over 10 years. But it might be a dangerous loan if you're only going to keep it for 3 years. So if I'm going to keep it for 3 years, what's my best loan? That might be a bridge loan, potentially. It might be a local bank loan. So we got to look at what's our whole business plan from start to finish. What are we really trying to achieve? And when we know what we're trying to achieve, that's when we can get the right loan product. And that's when we can implement the right strategies. And that's when we can underwrite it the proper way. Because if I'm flipping this apartment building, essentially, if it's 2 to 3 year hold, I might not care too much about cash flow. That might not be nearly as important. The future value might be what's the most important, which is the hardest to project at, might I add. But the future value, if I'm only going 2 to 3 years, is going to be extremely important because we're going through this whole process so quick, we're just not going to have time for cash flow to really matter that much, right? I mean, your IRR, we talk about your IRR is going to be way higher on a two-year hold if you can sell it for $2 million more than what you bought it versus if you have 15% cash on cash return. You know, that you would much rather have that big sale. So it really depends. If you're going to keep it for 10, 15 years, then having that cash flow is extremely important. Having that cash on cash is extremely important. So, and having that long-term fixed debt is really important.
Yep. So.
Awesome, John. Well, I think that's a wrap. What else you got?
Sounds good. If you'd like to contribute to this conversation, we'd love to continue it after the show. So just look us up on Facebook, on iTunes, on YouTube, and most of those places you can just scroll down and comment on this episode. And we'd like to get your input there. Of course, when you're looking us up, use the name Pillars of Wealth Creation.
Awesome, John. I appreciate you being on the show. And hey, make every day Saturday. Are you ready to start investing in real estate today but don't know where to start? Sometimes investing can seem way too complicated, but it actually couldn't be any easier than with homeinvest.com. You know the co-founder and my friend Nate Armstrong. He appeared on episode 20, and if you haven't heard it, go back and listen to it, episode number 20. Home Invest is a company that allows you to invest in turnkey real estate. Their goal is to build powerful investment tools that make real estate investing accessible to everyone. They have contractors and property managers available for you with the click of your mouse. While other real estate agents can only offer a property, Home Invest brings you a full turnkey package that allows you to diversify your investments, earn passive income, and start building equity in properties. Their simple, intuitive design allows newcomers and experienced investors alike to hit the ground running and to be able to choose the properties when they want and where they want. View easy-to-understand charts and data to allow you to buy in only a few clicks or just a simple phone call. With Home Invest, you'll be building your portfolio as quickly or as slowly as you would like. And right now, Home Invest is giving our listeners, Pillar of Wealth Creation listeners, a free course on how to finally win in real estate investing. So go to homeinvest.com/pillars. That's homeinvest.com/pillars. To claim your free course today.